The only song I remember is Gigi Papa. I can't remember quite how it goes. Something like Gigi Papa, Gigi Papa, Susumina ga kono sensei wa. I can't remember the rest of it.
It's just the beginning of the sentence. The teacher of the sparrow school says, and then.
Yep.
It's about little birds.
It's a little bird song. It's a kindergarten song, which fits. Okay. Deep, breathing deeply, becoming centered again. We've been talking about relationship, and as Kate reminded us, you know, last night in that very warm talk about relationship, Buddha to Buddha. And one relationship we haven't explored, but is very important to us, is the relationship of student-teacher. And so I think I'd like to talk about that today. And maybe just before I go any further, sound is okay? Everyone hears me? Oh, good? Okay, thanks. Now, I have some trepidation in bringing this this topic up, because there are many, maybe countless views about what a teacher is, how a teacher should act. And I'm also very mindful of the great harm that has been done by teachers in the student-teacher relationship, both in Asia, but also, of course, here in the West. But there is that old saying, fools rush in, where angels fear to tread, and so today my role is to be the role of the fool and talk a little bit about my understanding of what a teacher-student relationship is, or could be. Now, I think probably as many people here know, in traditional forms of Buddhist practice, there's immense importance placed on the role of a teacher. In fact, the teacher seems to be the center part of the teachings, at least in many forms of Asian Buddhism. Now, I suspect that this is largely coming from Confucian values that formed much of society structure in China, Korea, and Japan. And one of those values, perhaps the primary Confucian value, was filial piety, or the kind of child-parent relationship as being really central. And there are many kind of values connected around that I won't go into. But let me just kind of summarize that in East Asia, students should respect, trust, and obey the teacher. Are you guys listening? Obey? And the student should approach learning with humility. Now, on the other hand, the teacher should place the student's learning and well-being foremost. And this is also true. I'm not sure if it's has the same strength as it did even when I was living in Japan as a young man, but you know, teachers were highly respected, and they devoted their lives to teaching and to their students. I knew one teacher, for example, who it was typical to work 8 to 10 hours a day and then go in on the weekends to do extra activities with the students, and that was just kind of expected. That was the kind of devotion teachers often gave. So as the Buddhist tradition became established in China, of course, it was influenced by the Confucian values that were already present. But it's not just that. From the very beginning in India, the teachings and practices have been passed on from warm hand to warm hand, right? Always from a teacher to the student, student who then becomes a teacher, passes it on. It's always warm hand to warm hand. I love that expression. Very beautiful, I think, and very accurate. And although learning from written material, of course, is part of the tradition, liberation from our self-centeredness and self-attachment is almost impossible, I think, to do alone. We need help to do this. Because we so easily deceive ourselves. It's not uncommon for an experience of awakening to soon be used by the ego for more self and aggrandizement. I got that word out. Or on the other hand, we can fall into a kind of period of dryness in our practice. And maybe we'll just give up. So it's very hard to practice alone. So for these and probably many other reasons, in East Asia, teachers have played a very important function to check understanding and to guide transformation. And yet, even in East Asia, the role of teacher can be confused with that of a savior. So here's a story about one of our Chinese Chan or Zen ancestors, Huangbo Shiyun, who lived in the 9th century, which is during the Tang Dynasty. And at the time, he was a very famous teacher of a large monastery. And he was reputed to be 7 feet tall. So a big, strong guy. And as you will see, he was also famous for his pretty challenging speech, rough words. So here's the story. One day when Huangbo had taken his place on the teacher's seat in the assembly hall, he began, "You people are just like drunkards. I don't know how you manage to stand on your own 2 feet. Everyone will die laughing at you. Can't you understand, in the whole of this great Tang Empire, there are no teachers of Zen?" At this point, one of the monks present asked this, "How can you say that? At this very moment, as all can see, we are sitting face to face with you, an honored teacher of monks and a great leader of men." Huangbo answered, "I did not say there is no Zen. I merely pointed out there are no teachers of Zen." So in this short story, Huangbo tells his monks, and I think he tells each of us, there is no one here who will save you. There is no one here who will liberate you from the distress and pain of your life. No one will awaken you. I remember when I started practicing martial arts in Japan, many years ago, I was 19. Well, not that many years ago. I had a kind of subtle hope, I guess, that Aikido, because that's the martial art I was studying, if I studied hard with my teacher, it would smooth out my life. And then later on, oh, by the way, it didn't work. And then later on, I also had, I think, another subtle hope that my Zen teachers would perform some magic, and afterwards there would be a life more or less free of problems. Now, that didn't work out either. Intellectually, of course, I knew that that wouldn't happen. But there was a longing for just that. Please fix me. Please tell me the answer for a smooth and beautiful life. Now, gradually, the conviction grew that I am responsible for my own practice and my own awakening. And I mean beyond the intellectual understanding of that. A kind of deep heart, like a deep breath out. Yes, there is no savior for me. And although my teachers have shared information and practices with me, I have to confess that the only worthwhile truths that have shaped me and brought me some ease are the ones that arose from my own life. Sometimes sparked by a teacher, yes, but not given. In the Kalama Sutta, one of the earliest texts in the Buddhist canon, the Buddha stops at a village called Kalama. And the people, knowing of his wisdom, bring their confusion to him. They're confused by the conflicting words and concepts presented by the various wandering holy men who visit the village. And the Buddha, and I find this very moving, very fascinating, the Buddha did not say, "Trust me, I got the truth." Instead, he encouraged the people of Kalama to find their own way to the Dharma or to the truth, not to trust the charismatic teachers or a tradition or a custom or anything unless it has been verified by personal experience. Trust that. So for me, this means, yes, maybe our interest is sparked by something, we pick up a practice, but we have to see, is this really true? Does this really bring ease and comfort, awakening to our life? In a much later writing, known as the Maha Parinirvana Sutta, the Buddha famously advises his disciples to rely on their own practice and discernment. That's all you can rely on. Moments before his death, he told all of the people, bodhisattvas and other animals assembled by his deathbed, he said, "Let the Dharma and discipline I have taught you be your teacher." At first glance, this might seem like the Buddha is telling us no teacher is needed. But that's not quite right. The teacher is a guide to deeply understanding and appreciating both the discipline or the practice and the Dharma or the true nature of things. The Zen tradition holds strongly to the importance of teacher and at the same time acknowledges there are no teachers of Zen because Zen is not teachable. It's not a teachable skill or subject. Like, we can teach painting, we can teach watercolors, we can teach history of Tudor England, we can teach anatomy, we can teach our children how to brush their teeth. There are things we learn, of course, in our Zen practice. We learn how to take the good Zen meditation posture. We learn how to hold our chant books, how to bow. And eventually, if you hang around, which I hope all of you will, you'll learn how to ring bells, how to actually lead the chanting, how to support practice in the Zendo, as many people here are doing right now for us. But all of that is not the heart of Zen practice. It is part of the container of practice. It helps us. So consider this. In the fascicle Yobutsu that I talked about way back in my first talk. Dogen Zenji's writing, Only a Buddha and a Buddha. Dogen wrote this. The entire universe is the Dharma body of the self, which Kate mentioned last night, right? The entire universe is the body of the self. When you say the entire universe is the body of the self, words cannot express it. Interesting. Throughout Dogen's writings, and really throughout all the other writings of the Buddhist Sutras, attempts are made to express the inexpressible, all the while knowing words cannot express it. So if it can't be talked about in our conventional way, and teachers can't teach it in the conventional way, what is the student-teacher relationship? Well, let me start by saying this. It is special and not special. Maybe I should stop there. As we all know, relationships are messy. And the student-teacher relationships are no different from all the other messy relationships that make up our life. Sometimes the relationship will be informal, the student-teacher relationship, and brief. Sometimes it will be a lifelong relationship. But whether it's brief or long, it can be just as nuanced, complex, and strange as all other human relationships. Each student-teacher relationship is unique, of course, because each teacher and each student is unique. And if the relationship lasts for a while, it will also change, because all things change. At times, it will be very supportive, instructive, full of warmth, and at other times, challenging, irritating, and unclear. Does this sound like any of your relationships? At times irritating, challenging, and unclear? Yeah. In every student-teacher relationship that I know of, there are moments of disappointment, moments when the student particularly wants to end the relationship. And although I can't say this for sure, in all cases, there are moments when the teacher throws up her hands in frustration. In other words, this relationship, this student-teacher relationship, is like most human relationships, very sweet at times and very painful at times. But like all relationships, it can also be transformative. Maybe the one way, though, that this relationship is unique is that it is in service of the Dharma, of somehow going beyond the student and the teacher. So let's unpack this student relationship a little bit more, at least from my point of view. On one level, I think we turn towards a teacher for guidance. The teacher has walked on the trail before us. She's very familiar with the terrain. And although the trail may not be exactly the same, because each person is unique, it's probably similar, and that's good enough. But before walking on the trail very far, I think the student must first address the question of trust. A strong measure of trust, not blind following, but of considered, thoughtful trust needs to be present to follow through on the discipline of Zen practice, and also to really take responsibility and willingness to fully consider the suggestions and comments of a teacher. After all, the teacher might point out things that we don't want to see, or make suggestions that run counter to our desires. So having trust in a teacher is to some extent essential, if we're going to engage in the hard work of transformation. Just to give you one example, I remember when I began to engage in koan practice with Jan Chosen Bays quite a number of years ago now, I guess it's been, I diligently sitting in my session, and she kind of has this process of gradually working into giving you a koan. And of course I've done tons of reading, my God, before this. And finally got to the end of session where she actually gives a koan to a student. And it wasn't the one I wanted. She gave me this other thing, and I went, oh. But I didn't exactly have a lot of trust at that point built up, but I had some trust left over from my other teachers that had taught me, and so I thought, okay, I'll go with this one that she's given me, and I'm glad I did. So some trust is needed. And on the other hand, the teacher, though, needs to work constantly to be trustworthy. And to me, that means to be aware and guarding of one's own foibles and weak spots, and not to, to be just as careful as possible. Not perfect, but to be trustworthy. But here's the strange thing that I've noticed. At some point, we come to see that the trust we have placed in the teacher or in a teacher becomes trust in our own true being. Something happens as we mature and develop in our practice. So it is natural, I think, to turn to a teacher for guidance after our interest is piqued by some experience or some encounter or some reading that we've done. For example, old Bruce Lee movies may spark interest in martial arts. But we can only begin learning in a meaningful way from a person who really knows the discipline of martial arts. Books and YouTube videos, etc., can perhaps provide some inspiration, but they cannot take the place of a teacher. Zen teachers, for example, guide students in Zazen, giving some instructions, but also in encouraging exploration, both on the cushion and off the cushion. Teachers encourage us to apply the precepts to our lives, to deepen our daily practice in many different ways, and to study the teachings left by our ancestors. Each teacher and each situation is different. But in my experience, guidance comes during doksan, during ceremonies, dharma talks, but also informally, over tea and cookies, social events, work practice, and just very brief spontaneous chats. And it also comes in other ways that seem rather mysterious to me, like simply being in proximity. Dzogchen Norman Fisher, the teacher who ordained both Kate and ordained me, Norman often says something like, "We just hang out together, doing nothing special." And yet, in that doing nothing special, much is happening below the surface. which takes time to develop and ripen. Now, I must confess, I have suspected Norman is just lazy. Rather than providing structured learning environment, he has us just hang out together. Another Zen story. Long Tan made rice cakes for a living. But when he met the priest Tan Huang, he left home to join him. Tan Huang said, "Be my attendant. From now on, I will teach you the essential Dharma gate." After a year, Long Tan said, "When I arrived, you said you would teach me. But so far, nothing has happened." It feels like that way with Norman, doesn't it? Tan Huang said, "I've been teaching you all along." Long Tan said, "What have you been teaching me?" Tan Huang replied, "When you greet me, I bow. When I sit, you stand beside me. When you bring me tea, I receive it from you." Now, when I consider my experience with Norman Fisher and my other teachers, I must say I'm not sure what a good teacher is. I've always been cautious about teachers who are charismatic, and I think it's best to take lots of time before committing to studying with a teacher. Does he or she walk the talk? Does she admit to not knowing everything? Does he speak to me in a way that really rings true? There are lots of questions I think we can consider and ruminate about. And while all of that is very important, at the same time, there is a danger in trying hard to gauge the quality of a teacher as if there was some objective standard. So maybe what is most valuable after working with the teacher for a little while is to ask and listen with your heart this question: is this the teacher for me? It is true, much of our Zen practice we do on our own, it seems. In Zazen, there's no one between you and the wall you're facing, or between you and this lovely beige brown carpet. And at some point, our innermost fears and anxieties will arise and demand attention. Throughout most of our lives, when strong afflictive emotions or thoughts arise, we often respond with fight, flight, or freeze. But this is exactly when we require tremendous courage and steadfastness. In our practice, we turn toward what we typically avoid and compassionately hold it with awareness. We don't fight, flight, freeze, or fix. And this is very challenging to do. And sooner or later, we need encouragement. We need support to walk in such unfamiliar and frightening territory. Now, a teacher cannot make the path easier. At least I don't believe that. But a teacher can reassure and maybe bring some calm to our agitated heart. And there's something else. When we work with a teacher for a long time, the teacher also takes on the role of witness. She sees your practice as it is in this moment and over time. And if there is a ground of trust, the teacher can witness our vulnerability, those moments when we really struggle with doubt, as we work out our life. And it's very powerful to be seen exactly as you are and not criticized or rejected. The teacher also has the role of questioner, or maybe poker. Right? Poke. Giving honest feedback, maybe pointing out students' blind spots. I think that is important, but only works if there's trust. And I would add, maybe the teacher should not consider doing this unless the student has requested it and both feel it's beneficial. After all, what's the point of pointing out someone's weakness or challenging point if that person cannot hear it? They must be able to hear it, for it to be of benefit. At any rate, I realize this is just my own comment, my own thoughts, and this kind of flies in the face of that traditional image, right, of the Zen teacher kind of snatching the rug out from underneath the feet of the student until, over and over again, until he's no longer standing on any carpet at all. But just in the present moment. The old Zen stories are full of examples of a monk after a powerful experience, assuming now that they are fully awakened, and the Zen teacher just kind of tweaks their nose or laughs out loud or simply tells them to go back and sit in the Zendo somewhere. So these are some of the roles or functions, I think, of a Zen teacher. And there are probably many more. But as I said earlier, like any relationship, it will be both beautiful and it will be frustrating, both life-giving and painful. And all we can ask is that both make their best effort, both student and teacher. Another short Zen story. Once a student who was doing a practice period at Tassajara approached Suzuki Roshi and asked, "Why haven't you enlightened me yet? Why haven't you enlightened me yet?" And Suzuki Roshi answered politely, "I'm making my best effort." He may have told the student, "Bugger off." He may have told the student it was her job to make a more sincere effort. Or he may have said, "Well, you are already a Buddha, so don't worry about it." Or he may have given her some other kind of Zenny answer. But he didn't. He just said, "I am making my best effort." As Huangbo said, there are no teachers of Zen. There are just skillful roles that we pick up as we walk this path of awakening together. In our Soto Zen tradition, all the lineage papers, for example, those you receive for Jukai or those you receive when you become a priest, have what's called the bloodline. And it's a red line on the paper that begins with the Buddha, goes through all the ancestors to you who receive the Jukai paper or the ordination paper, and then it circles back up to the Buddha again. All the teachers from India, China, Japan, North America, back up to the Buddha, And I find this a wondrous image of trust. We are in this together. Sometimes we are the student, sometimes the teacher. These roles are not fixed. It's just what we inhabit for a moment or two. At this moment, holding the microphone, I'm in the teacher seat. But in a few moments, maybe back in the Dokusan room, facing a student, maybe I will be in the student seat, really. And the student will be teaching me. Zhao Zhou, the famous Chinese ancestor, after he had practiced for decades, began to wander in China and teach. He was said to be 80 years old when he started teaching. Kate and I have started a bit earlier than that. But he said when he left, if I meet a young girl of 6 years of age and she can teach me, I will learn. So I'll end with one more story, a Zen story of Dongshan, Liangjie, recognized as one of the co-founders of our Soto Zen School. So here's the story. There's a vegetarian feast was being prepared to commemorate the anniversary of Dongshan's teacher's death, Yunyan. A monk asked Dongshan, what instruction did you receive from your great master Yunyan? And Dongshan replied, although I was with him, I did not receive any instruction. The monk asked, if he did not give you any instruction, why are you preparing food to offer him in his memory? And Dongshan replied, I do not hold him in honor because of his great virtues and his Buddha Dharma. I do so only because of his refusal to reveal the truth to me. The monk asked, since you are about to offer food in memory of the late Yunyan, do you still agree with him? Dongshan replied, I half agree and half disagree with him. The monk asked, why do you not entirely agree with him? And Dongshan replied, if so, I would do him a great injustice. There is so much more that may be said about the student-teacher relationship. And at some point must be said, but not now. Now is the time to just practice together with the image and the knowledge that we are all Buddhas, each one of us, and yet at the same time struggling with the pain of our life. Let's bring forth here both wisdom and compassion, supporting each other as best we can. Like Suzuki Roshi, let's make our best effort. And as we do this, let go of our imaginations, our imaginings of whatever goal we have, and just practice. Dogen wrote, do not get stuck in loving a carved dragon. We should go forward and love the real dragon. One thing I didn't mention, Human beings can be teachers, but so can everything else. And it's so beautiful outside. Loon Lake is a beautiful teacher. Sometimes she pours rain down on us, reminding us of our life. Sometimes we feel like we're just in a rainstorm all the time. And sometimes it's beautiful. So I think we should try to spend as much time outside as we can, learning, opening up to the Dharma of Loon Lake itself.